listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 p.m. GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more. You're listening to Dissident Island. It's the 18th of October, 2013. It's the 18th, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is
the 18th. Tomorrow's the 19th, which is the Anarchist Book Fair Day, which is the anarchist day of the year in the UK, at least, where all the anarchists come out and celebrate and enjoy themselves in various intellectual ways. But tonight we have two very special guests here on the show with us tonight. Hello.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hi. So could you introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about yourselves?
Well, I'm Lorenzo Comboa Irvin from the United States, the lower section in Memphis, Tennessee now. That's where we're living now, myself and my wife. And I've been an activist for years in the state of Tennessee and in the southern states particularly. An anti-Klan activist and an anti-racist organizer, going back to also the civil rights movement in the 1960s and Black Power days and all that. I'm here, we're here, live to do, well, we've done the first portion of the tour, which was to go to various cities in the UK and become part of the Black History Month celebrations here, and we're back in London tomorrow, of course, be part of the London Anarchist Book Fair. I am an anarchist, by the way, and have been for about 40 years, and had written a book even called Anarchism and the Black Revolution, which is now back in print, by the way. Plug. and it'll be out there tomorrow for sale. Plug. So, this is one of my favorite places in all the world to come to, is, you know, especially in London. I've always liked it in London. I've been here 5 or 6 times now, well, maybe even more, I don't know, but at least 5 or 6 times. And, you know, been active in all kinds of stuff like it here. Ta-da.
My name is Jonina Abron Irvin. I am I'm a lot of things, I guess. I'm a former member of the Black Panther Party in the United States. I was the last editor of the Black Panther newspaper. I have been a social justice community organizer for 40 plus years. Worked on issues concerning police brutality. Back when there was the anti-apartheid movement was still going on regarding South Africa, I was part of that. I've traveled to Africa a few times. I went to the United Nations World Conference Against Racism back in 2001. I am an author. I have written several essays about the Black Power movement in the United States in the late 60s, and I have written my own book called Driven by the Movement, Activists of the Black Power Era, in which I interviewed 20 people who were active in various Black Power groups during the late 60s and 1970s. I'm retired now, but I used to be a lecturer, as you say here in the UK. I'm a journalist, and I taught journalism, news writing, and reporting. I guess that's it in a nutshell.
Wow. so that's quite a lot. So you've both obviously had like really interesting lives and kind of trajectories, but maybe we could go sort of right back to the start and ask you how you first got involved in kind of the Black Panther Party and the Black Power movement. How did that sort of come about for both of you?
Well, for me, you know, I had been a youth organizer way back in 1960 when the youth wing of the civil rights movement came into existence. And I always tell people, you know, that there was, in fact, two separate wings of the civil rights movement. You had the wing that started in the late 1950s with Dr. Martin Luther King, and you know, it had a bus boycott that forced the end of segregation in that city. But there was also a wing that came into existence in 1960, in the year of 1960, that was solely youth-based and youth-led, and was actually the most militant wing of the civil rights movement. And it was that wing that I belonged to. And in one way or another, I wasn't able to be a, traveling organizer, but I did organize in my hometown. It's interesting what happened in 1960. These youth formed their own movement, and they had what would today be called occupations. Yeah. And they were going into these racist facilities, you know, that didn't serve black people, you know, public accommodations, whether they were restaurants or movie theaters or what have you. And so my teeth were, more or less my teeth were driven from that period of the term, you know, your tooth or your life began when you found what it was that drove you. And what drove me was in that year to see all these black people standing up against segregation and standing up against racism. And so that was what started it for me. And the movement I belonged to, ultimately, since it lasted 10 years, it was the source for black power. The ideology and so forth came from one of my a person from my hometown, Willie Ricks, and also who's known then, Stokely Carmichael. And they you know, sort of popularized the idea of Black Power, but the concept and the actual implementation of it went much further than that, because the youth almost immediately seized upon the idea and would scream Black Power when they were rebelling against police brutality and burning the cities down in America. And so it was made into a militant anthem almost immediately. It was picked up by the movement itself. There was this wing that was primarily educational, poetry, cultural nationalist wing. And then there was the wing of the revolutionary organizations, like the Black Panther Party. It wasn't the only one. It was certainly the most prominent one and most successful one, of that period. And we're talking about, if we looked at the time frame, it'd be from 1955 to 65 for the Civil Rights Movement, you know, pretty much living and dying. And then the transformation into Black Power in 1965, coming on up to 1975. The second year or so of Black Power produced the founding of the Black Panther Party. Black Panther Party and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee had a brief merger or alliance or whatever. People debate over what it was, but they came together. The leadership of SNCC were given positions in the newly formed Black Panther Party. And also, many of the members that were in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee joined the Black Panther Party or became part of it in one fashion or another. And so this is how it started for me. First as this really young kid, really, 12 years old, yeah, who became excited and motivated over, you know, the original sit-in protests. And then when the movement was going through all these transformations, and by 1965 had become a Black Power organization and had thrown off liberalism, pretty much thrown off the liberal ideal of just excelling for the right to vote or the right to sit in a restaurant. And all. They were throwing that off because they wanted more. They wanted an end to the war where Black people were being killed in massive numbers. And SNCC became the major civil rights organization that was against the war. It came out against the war and started organizing the youth to resist the draft, to expose the racism of the whole war itself, and how Black people were being used as cannon fodder. Mm-hmm. All of this started happening before Dr. King ever said a word about it. Mm-hmm. But the white mass media attributed to him, you know, because he was more of a safe figure than these youth were. You know, we were calling for revolution and everything else by that time, you know, and practicing armed self-defense and had met with Malcolm X. And by 1964, Malcolm X, before he died the next year, he'd influenced, had met two times at least with the leaders of SNCC. And once in Africa, in Ghana, and the other time in Selma, Alabama. And right before the protests took place there. And he had talked them into or made them see the idea of using armed self-defense against the Ku Klux Klan, that no more lives had to be lost just because people were unwilling to, you know, use what was natural to resist white supremacy, white racist organizations. So we went from the one stage of strictly nonviolence all the way over to armed self-defense and later to the question of a new revolutionary movement and becoming part of that, which became the Black Panther Party. Jonina can talk more in depth about the Black Panther Party because Jonina was in the party itself longer than I was. I was a political prisoner by 1969. I was doing life in prison. And the repression had come down and started by that time. The counterintelligence program and so forth and so on. The lifeblood of the party, how it functioned and all of that. I can only talk about what happened leading up to it and the early stages of it, you know. As I said, the merger and so forth, the leaders and so forth. But the actual functioning of it as a single organization I was in prison by that time, and she can talk about it more in depth.
Well, my background is a little different than Lorenzo's. I actually grew up in the Midwestern part of the United States, and as a kid growing up in the 50s and early 60s, you know, I would watch the news with my parents on television about all the civil rights protests that were going on in the southern part of the country. And I remember one a big protest that was held in the other Birmingham, Alabama, in the United States. And by this time, the adult wing of the movement was having a lot of problems. And so they brought in kids, school kids, kids my age. And I can remember watching these kids on national news protesting and the police using fire, water hoses against them. And, you know, like it was really something. I was like, wow, you know, these are kids my age. I was probably, yeah, 12 years old. I couldn't believe that kids my age were doing this. And it was really very inspiring to me. And I said, well, when I'm old, I was obviously too young. At one point, they had a voter registration drive for black people in the South who could not vote at that time. And I wanted to, you know, go down for the summer. It was called the Freedom Summer of 1964. And I wanted to go, but I was barely 16. My mother said, no, you're not going. She said that, you know, black people are getting killed down there, and they were getting killed. So, you know, I wasn't old enough to go. I was like Lorenzo. But I was inspired by the youth. And I thought, you know, as soon as I get out of school, I'm going to join the movement. I did later. I joined the Black Panther Party after I finished graduate school. Joined the Black Panther Party in Detroit, Michigan. Detroit, Michigan is the automobile capital of the United States. I joined there, and my work there involved working in the main programs. We had breakfast for a school children program, the Black Panther Party in many of the cities where we had chapters and branches. We served a free hot breakfast to kids during the regular school year. We did that because a lot of kids were going to school who were living in these low-income neighborhoods where the party was based, would go to school hungry. And, you know, a lot of kids don't like school anyway. And so I know my daughter always hated school. And so that if you have an empty stomach, you're hungry, you know, you're going to like it even less. So we understood the importance of kids having a good breakfast before they went to school. So we started the free breakfast program for children. And that's one of the programs that I worked in. This program was one of our most successful programs that we had, actually. It got a lot of community support. And what happened was that it was a popular program, but it was a program that was designated by the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, our domestic police agency. It was branded as the Black Panther Party's single most dangerous program. You know, and people look at you like, oh, no, you must be kidding. You know, we have the documents that there were some FBI documents that were stolen from an FBI office and that were leaked to the news media. And you could see for yourselves, they said this, that the breakfast program was the single most dangerous program that we had. They had already branded the Black Panther Party as the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. That's a whole other issue, how 5,000 basically young people can be the biggest threat to the internal security of the United States is something. But the breakfast program, what the FBI realized was the breakfast program was powerful because it raised issues of hunger and poverty in the United States. We began to raise mass consciousness about those issues. And sometimes the news media would come in and film us serving the breakfast. And these got on TV. So the FBI considered the program to be dangerous because they knew we were really doing a lot to raise the consciousness about hunger and poverty. Ultimately, this program forced the U.S. educational system to start serving free hot lunches to kids because people in the black community were saying, well, the Black Panthers can give the kids the breakfast. They're a small organization. You know, why aren't the public schools giving our kids meals? So now there is a for low-income children in the United States, there is a free hot lunch program, which the government will never admit it, but everybody knows that if it had not been for the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, there would not be a free hot lunch program in the country today. So that was one of the programs that I worked in, one of our what we call our survival programs. Huey Newton, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party. By the way, the Black Panther Party was founded 47 years ago this past Tuesday in Oakland, California. It was founded October 15th, 1966. So it was 47 years ago. By Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who were two black college students at the time, Huey Newton wrote that black people needed to have, we had to survive pending revolution. The Black Panther Party was not started as a socialist organization or a Marxist organization, but we did embrace some of those ideas. We favored a socialist revolution in the United States. And so Huey wrote that, okay, you know, but the revolution is not here right now. We have to survive pending revolution. So we had various survival programs. The breakfast, the free hot breakfast for kids was one of that programs. Prior to that, the focus of the Black Panther Party initially was on armed self-defense against police brutality. That was the initial program that Huey Newton and Bobby Steele started with. We had a 10-point platform and program, and actually the program for armed self-defense against police brutality was actually point number 7. It wasn't even the first point. The first point was we demanded full employment for black people. But police brutality was so bad in the black community, and that's why Huey and Bobby started the Black Panther Party to counter that. And in the United States, under our federal constitution, all people in the United States have a right to bear arms. That's, you know, it's being debated a lot now because of all the gun violence there is, but it's part of our federal constitution. The American people have a right to bear arms. And also in the state of California at that time, people, adults 18 and up, had a right to carry a gun or rather on the streets. You didn't have to have a special permit. So Huey and Bobby said, okay, we have the right to bear arms, and in California we can carry guns. So they advocated that black people form armed self-defense groups to counter the police brutality. And they went around the Black Panther Party was started in Oakland, California, Northern California. So they went around Northern California observing incidents of police brutality. And they would advise people of their legal rights. They would say, you know, the police are violating your rights. Huey Newton wrote a small kind of like little legal book for people who needed to know what to do if they were stopped by the police. And we would distribute that to people. So it didn't take long for the police and the politicians were, you can obviously imagine, quite upset about these young black people going through the community, you know, with guns, which was legal. They couldn't really do anything unless, you know, you broke the law, because it was legal to have a gun. They were very upset about it, so they moved to change the law in the state of California to disarm. It was meant to disarm the Black Panther Party. And up until that point, the party was pretty much a Northern California phenomenon. But when they proposed the legislation to disarm the party, a group of Black Panthers went to the California legislature. For those listeners who are not familiar with how the United States is organized, we have 50 states. Each state has its own legislature and its own capital. And so the Black Panther Party delegation went into the California legislature, just burst into the room with their guns to protest this legislation. At that point, the Black Panther Party, it began to spread around the country, because that made national news, these young black people rushing into a legislative body. And, you know, it brought terror to the hearts of many white people, but it inspired many young black people, so our numbers began to grow at that time. So that's kind of sort of the early, quick overview of some of the things the Black Panther Party did. Not comprehensive, but we can't be here all night, so just the highlights.
I'm not a hunter, but I'm told that in places like in the Arctic, where indigenous people sometimes might hunt a wolf, they'll take a double-edged blade and they'll put blood on the blade and they'll melt the ice and stick the handle in the ice so that only the blade is protruded, and that a wolf will smell the blood and wants to eat, and it'll come and lick the blade trying to eat. And what happens is when the wolf licks the blade, of course, he cuts his tongue and he bleeds and he thinks he's really having a good meal. He drinks and he licks and of course he's drinking his own blood and he kills himself. That's what the imperialists did to us with crack cocaine. You got these young brothers out there thinking that they're getting something that they're gonna make a living with. They're getting something they can buy a car like the white people have cars. Why can't I have a car? They're getting something so they can get a piece of gold. The white people have gold. Why can't I have gold? They're getting something to get a house. The white people have a house. Why can't I have a house? And they actually think that it's something that's bringing resources to them, but they're killing themselves just like the wolf who's licking the blade, and they're slowly dying without knowing. That's what's happening to the community. You with me on that? That's exactly and precisely what happens to the community. And instead of blaming the hunter who put the damn handle and the blade in the ice for the wolf, that what happens is the wolf gets blamed for trying to live. That's what happens in our community. You don't blame the person, the victim, you blame the oppressor. Imperialism, white power is the enemy. Was the enemy when it first came to Africa, snatched up the first African, brought us here against our will, is the enemy today.
So, I mean, do you view the emergence of the Black Panther Party as a result of the civil rights movement not going far enough in terms of empowerment of black people?
Yes and no. yes, in the sense that the adult wing and the wing that was dominated by the conservative Christian leadership certainly settled for basic rights. But there had always been a tendency within the civil rights movement itself, as I was pointing out, to actually the Black Power movement, which is what the Black Panther Party was part of. The Black Power movement came out of the civil rights movement. The Black Power movement actually came out of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They had become radicalized by discussions with Malcolm X, and, you know, in discussions and also activists inside the group having previous discussions about black power and as a political theory and so forth. And so all of these things crystallized inside this movement. And so this movement was the bedrock, you might say, of black power. Black power then spread all over the country. The Southern Civil Rights Movement, which you have to understand, was a movement based in one part of the country. And in other parts of the country where black people were, and in urban areas particularly, black people felt like they weren't really represented or didn't get very much out of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. They also didn't have all this abiding faith in the federal government that the civil rights leaders like Dr. King and the other primarily Christian pastors had in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was led by Dr. King. So, yes, you had the situation where the youth wing came about because they were dissatisfied with the conservative nature of the protest movement led by Dr. King and others. And that youth wing ultimately produced the ideology, the militant ideology of black power, which was going to fight to overthrow racism and capitalism. You know, ultimately, that was one of the objectives, certainly with the emergence of the Black Panther Party. So the so-called radical wing of civil rights produced black power, and black power produced the Black Panther Party, the radical wing of the Black Panther Party. But there was also a more I would say, conservative wing, even of Black Power, which was more about you know, African culture alone, or giving speeches, or having plays, and you know, other cultural expressions, which were important. I mean, you know, for people who had been despised and dehumanized, it was important to have you know, this kind of a cultural or display. You know, the wearing the afro and all this sort of thing, and millions of people were touched by that. Millions of people were brought into a new level of consciousness about this, so that was important. But ultimately, like the brother said, that ain't gonna free us. You know, some poems alone ain't gonna free us. And they realized, and so it kind of opened the door for a movement like the Black Panther Party, for a wing like the Black Panther Party to come in existence. Now, there had always been, even in the civil rights period, there had been self-defense organizations, actually. There was one, but they were very isolated. There was one in North Carolina where some veterans from the Korean War had come in the mid-50s and formed a NACP wing that was, in fact, an armed militia. Mm-hmm. An armed militia. They themselves were armed, and they taught their wives and other community members to defend against the Ku Klux Klan. And so when the Klan did attack in the, was it 57, 50, somewhere in there, when the Klan, and the Klan was known to mass in that area. They were huge, thousands of them in one area. And when they attacked, the Black community shot it out with them and drove them back. And some of them were wounded and all that sort of thing. And then there were some white people who were driving through, innocently driving through, and got trapped. And one of the leaders of the group took them and you know, try to protect them from getting attacked by Black people who didn't know them from anyone else. And so they used, the state of North Carolina used that to say, oh, they've kidnapped these white people and so on and so on. And they brought the criminal charges that drove them out of the country. And those two were in exile for quite some time. Then there was the Deacons for Defense and Justice that were in Louisiana, Alabama, and Georgia. And they used to march with civil rights demonstrators to protect them from vicious white racists that would come. If you were in a march, they would come and hit you with a brick, stab you with a knife, anything, you know, shoot you, and this kind of stuff. And so they formed this militia, and the militia would march on the outside to prevent these white racist people from getting access to organizers. So these people sort of laid the foundation for the Black Panther Party to come in later on with armed self-defense in urban areas. And, you know, now these were pretty much in the South, and they were rural, fairly rural areas. Well, the Black Panther Party applied the logic of armed self-defense to an urban environment. So all of this stuff, the civil rights movement led the foundation and became the transformation, actually, of what became the Black Power movement. And then ultimately, out of the Black Power movement came the Radical Wing, which was the Black Panther Party. And there were others as well who were smaller, and you don't know anything about them in this period. Most people don't, even in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I guess kind of, well, there's a fascinating period of history, but we don't have a whole lot of time to go into it. But so I'm going to kind of gloss over or move a step ahead. I mean, the results of the civil rights movement are very, at least to people outside anywhere, are far more tangible than the results that were gained by the Black Power movement and the Black Panthers. But I mean, from your perspective, what is the legacy of the Black Power movement and the Black Panther Party? I mean, do you think there are tangible achievements that you can point to? I mean, you pointed to one with the free school lunches, but in terms of like advancing empowerment, do you think that there is anything that you can kind of point
to?
Well,
many of the things that they've attributed to, in fact, the civil rights movement gains that the civil rights movement won were, in fact, won by the Black Power movement, because the Black Power movement was the ideological and political anchor that forced them to negotiate with, you know, people like Dr. King and others. And in fact, the institutional framework, you know, and so forth, which they attribute to civil rights, in fact, much of that also came about because of urban insurrections and other pressures. I mean, without the pressures of the Black working class and in the cities and urban areas, there would have been no real gains for any of us. So although the government, for its own reasons, attribute all this stuff to the civil rights and the moderate wing, the point of fact is most of the things that were won by black youth to change, to transform not only the legal framework, but to actually transform the position of black people within the society, in urban areas. And, you know, I'm not saying they ended all forms of racism. Obviously, that didn't happen with any wing, with either one of them. But they took and transformed, for instance, the idea of even black representatives. You wouldn't even have a so-called president today if it wasn't for black power. The ideas of black power, you know, changed the entire country.
Okay. Well, where would you say black power is today? I mean, you just mentioned we have Obama as president, right, of the United States, but at the same time we have one of the longest sustained periods of extreme poverty,
right,
and social destitution for large parts of the United States, mm-hmm, and that includes a disproportionate number of people of color. So where is the black power movement today?
Well, there's not a black power movement per se. In fact, sometimes if you use that, people kind of look at you funny, like, you know, well, that was a long time ago. Our organization that we have, we started just less than 2 years ago, Black Autonomy Federation, is an organization that believes that black people should, you know, independent of politicians and the government, should, you know, take charge of the issues in our community, which is what people did in the Black Power period. That's what they did. They demanded changes. People organized community groups to deal with issues in their community. You know, today, I guess in a sense, you know, we're kind of carrying on that tradition, although we don't call it black power necessarily. It's, you know, black autonomy. You know, we're not trying to recreate the Black Panther Party or the Black Power movement, because that movement was developed at a specific time in history, very specific socioeconomic conditions in the United States, which no longer exist. Back in 1966, the Black Panther Party demanded full employment for our people, for black people. And now, unemployment for black people is far worse than it was in 1966. In fact, it's at its highest level since the Great Depression, you know, in the 1930s. Police brutality is much worse. So we can't even begin to talk about recreating something. You know, I'm proud of the Black Panther Party. I'm proud that I was in that movement. But we can't live. We can learn some lessons, and we certainly have. But we can't live in the past. We have to continue on to deal with what's going on right now. So I guess my answer would be that, you know, through the work that we do with our Black Autonomy Federation, we're trying to carry on the ideals of black power, but we move beyond that particular concept of black power.
And also, you know, there's the issue that in this period is a reflection of the changes of racism. You know, we don't have formalized segregation. This is black people can't go over here and live in this house, or they can't go in this restaurant, or they can't. It's a different kind of structure of oppression, you know. So where we are at, the city we're in, Memphis, is the poorest big city in the United States. It's kind of reflected also in a place like Detroit. So economic segregation is a reality in this period. Mass imprisonment is a reality in this period. Massive black infant mortality is a reality in this period. So we've got new forms of oppression, but also new, we need new strategies for organizing. And we've been kept back, I think, and many of us think this, that we've been actually kept back from building a revolutionary black movement because of the co-optation by politicians, by the legal framework of the civil rights, and all these other things that have pushed people. That's why in this period, you got a black president, but his job is to neutralize black protests, you see. And you've had 4,000 black politicians elected since 1965 with the new civil rights law that came into existence then. But nothing has changed tangibly, in the sense of, you know, the oppression itself. We're still oppressed. The forms may differ, and all of that, but we still have the necessity of building a movement. Now, it's more difficult today because people are not as convinced that they have to get out in the streets. Many people are told, in fact, not to get out in the streets. We've arrived. We got a black president. We got this. We got black faces on TV. We got all, you know, none of these really mean anything, though. They don't mean anything whatsoever in terms of political power on the grassroots level, in terms of stopping the police from killing poor black people or killing black people, period. None of this means anything. And it's just subterfuge. And, you know, but it is subterfuge enough that it has prevented a massive black movement from coming into existence in this period. In fact, it's prevented a radical movement of any sort from coming into existence in this period. And we need to understand that. So we're in a stage right now. One of the goals of the counterintelligence program run by the FBI was not just to destroy the Black Panther Party, but to destroy the base for it, to destroy the idea of revolutionary protests.
Just shifting focus very slightly, I mean, both of you have mentioned the FBI and the kind of the repression that the Black Panther Party experienced, and you kind of touched upon the incarceration that a lot of black mm-hmm. activists experienced. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that and your own experiences of prison mm-hmm. in that time, and if you had any thoughts about how the prison system has developed in the United States right. subsequently.
Very good question. In my own case, I was one of a number of black revolutionaries that went to prison in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And enough of us went to prison because of the crushing of black organizations, not only the Black Panther Party, but even SNCC and others, and also the New Left, the White New Left, and the American Indian Movement and other movements produced hundreds of political prisoners, some of whom are in prison to this very day, in fact. And it's been, you know, years and years. Some of them have done 40 years. Mm-hmm. This happened and because, as I said, of the repression, but inside the prisons, some of us were able to build a base, organizing base, an activist base to fight back against, for instance, where I went, the prison I went to was the so-called Ku Klux Klan jail in Indiana. We were able to build a movement that destroyed the Klan in that prison. You know, I got 35 years added onto my sentence, but still, you know, it was worth it. I mean, to destroy a Klan clavern inside of the federal prison there that had killed several black prisoners and so forth. We also recognized that there was a protest movement building inside the prisons, period. In Attica, 1971, yeah. Massive rebellion. People all over the world began to understand what was really happening inside the prisons and how much of a concentration camp they were. Now, if you looked at that and how important that was, and you know, my own struggles included in that time frame, this was really a revolutionary development. There were a lot of people on our side. This is how the prison movement actually developed. And this is during a time when I connected with the Anarchist Black Cross here in England and became the first American prisoner to be adopted. But, you know, this is when the longtime anarchist Albert Meltzer and Stuart Christie, a Scot, had set up the movement, the newly formed movement, in the early 70s, 60s and 70s. And I, through that association, that pushed me out of prison. It actually created a mass movement strong enough to push me out of prison in the 1983 I got out. And but what's happening now is different. You've got mass imprisonment, mainly from the drug trade. And here's what happened. The American government bought in and created crack cocaine. They put it in the communities. They put it in the hands of drug dealers. Now, these things are documented. These security services of the CIA and others actually created these drugs and put them in the hands of drug dealers on the West Coast first, and then, you know, in New York later, and it spread all over the country. This was you. This destroyed the black community, the foundations of many black communities, and resulted in many people losing their lives, both in terms of shooting, killing each other, as well as the police invading places and shooting and killing people. They've killed thousands since the time of the introduction of crack cocaine. All of this is a way to control the black population. And control and to create a police state, effectively. Paramilitary policing was never as strong before the war on drugs became a reality. And so when we look at the United States and you see you have 2.3 million people in the prison system, and you got the United States as a small country in comparison to the rest of the world, 5% of the population of the world, holding 25% of all the prisoners of the world. And so you have to look at these things. What this means effectively is that we've reached a new stage of, and we need to organize a new kind of movement. And so part of our tour is to talk about how we have to build a mass movement against mass imprisonment, you know, international solidarity movement. And so that's part of the reason why we're having these tours and talking about it. Among other things that we talk about in terms of the historical retrospective of the Black Panther Party.
I mean, you said that you were the recipient of massive amounts of solidarity when you were imprisoned. A bit, what's the state of the prison solidarity movement in the United States at the minute? I mean, is there active solidarity with people who are imprisoned because of drug charges or anything like that, or is that yet to come?
Well, there are some groups that work around the issues. There are some anarchist groups that work around the issues. The anarchist groups are primarily in the United States are involved in support work for long-term political prisoners, those who've been in 40, 45 years. And you have some community groups around the country who may be in their own cities have formed kind of support groups, but there's no really mass kind of prison support movement like there was back in the 1960s and early 1970s. That kind of movement does not exist, and it's missing. It's sorely needed now because of so many people. And in the black community, at least close to 50% of the people who are held in prison in the United States are black. A large percentage are Hispanic, Puerto Rican, Chicano. So it directly impacts our communities greatly. I think, the problem is aside from the smaller groups that do work around prison solidarity, which are good, there are some small ones that do some very good work. I think, though, nowadays there's a need for a new kind of prison organizing. In fact, our organization, Black Autonomy Federation, has started the Black Autonomy Prison Federation, it's got the outside, and it's very new, so we're not well developed, and I can't tell you all the things we've been doing because we just got started. We have the outside supporters like myself and Lorenzo and others, but it was actually started because some black anarchist prisoners who are in prison or others who are, radical, who have become radicalized, asked our organization to start something. They've been after Lorenzo for years to start a, some kind of a black prison group with inside the prison. So we do have a group of prisoners, in different parts of the country who are trying to raise consciousness now. I mean, it's different now. You have a lot of the, particularly young people, black people, Chicano people who go to prison, are in prison connected with the so-called war on drugs. So you have, there is gang influence inside the prison. So there's a lot of work that has to be done to raise the consciousness of prisoners. Obviously, we're not in prison. We can't do it. But there are prisoners who are there who want to raise that consciousness, who understand how they got there, who want to deal with the gang, the kind of gang mentality. So they are beginning to do work in various parts of the country. It's been its very early stages. But that's what's needed now, is to really kind of a re-education of the youth and things.
I can just about visualize the things that the brothers and the sisters had to cope with at the turn of the 18th century.
in Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi, as human beings in bondage. I can faintly hear the voice of one of those so-called masses saying, "All right, you niggers, line up over there and let's see what kind of stock I've bought." And I can hear a mother sobbing softly for a baby, for he was to go to the big house and be raised as a good nigger. And she was to be added to a copper line of slaves headed for an auction block in New Orleans to be sold to the highest bidder. I can hear the moans and groans as they worked those hot fields to satisfy a cause that could only mean something to the slave owners themselves. Yeah, I can see them now.
So I was hoping to hear about the, you're going to be giving a talk tomorrow at the Anarchist Book Fair about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan and, well, the re-rise, I suppose, and sort of anti-racist organizing and the movement in the U.S. But perhaps before we talk about tactics, could you give us a sort of the background of what's actually happening? Where is this coming from? Like, where is the rise of white supremacist groups coming from in the States?
Well, there has been, you know, the Ku Klux Klan is the oldest fascist organization in the world. And this goes back, their initial development goes back to the end of the American Civil War in the 1870s, 1880s. And they've gone through various formations, and then they've been knocked back, defeated, or they fell apart, or whatever the case may be. You know, one of the most dangerous developments, for instance, was in the 1920s when they had 4 to 6 million members in a country of less than 100 million people. And so they've gone through periods of great popularity like that. They've also gone through a stage where they were an underground force, like in the 1950s and 60s, when they were trying to resist resist the civil rights movement. And they were bombing people's houses, and they were bombing churches, and they were doing things like that. So we've gone through different phases. Now they're in a phase where they're building a new kind of mass movement, a so-called neo-Confederate movement, and they're hiding behind the idea of this being some kind of rights movement, white rights movement, and they're also playing on the fact that in the United States you still have massive unemployment as a result of the capitalist collapse of the 2007, and so many white people are out of work, especially in Memphis. You got double digit unemployment. You have had for some time. In the general sense, it's even larger in the black community, but the white supremacists are trying to use this to say, well, the reason you are in fact without a job, or you're poor, or this is happening to your family, is because this black president is doing this to you, and he's punishing you white people, and and it's because black people have been given civil rights and so forth and so on, and they're getting their rights at the expense of the white man, as they put it. And so they are using this period and this predicament to organize. This is their period to organize, using all these contradictions that are happening to the American people as a whole, but they're singling out white people to say, well, this is happening to you, the white man. You were in control, and now you got a black president, and he's telling you what to do, and he's doing this to you. He's causing your misery. And so they obviously want to get people and ask people to join the fascist cause, to join the party. And they're also attempting to, and they have been for quite some time, use the fact that the original head of the Ku Klux Klan, back from way back in 1870s, the original first, he wasn't founding member, but he was certainly the first Grand Dragon, is buried in a park in Memphis, Tennessee. He and his wife are at the basin of a statue of a Knight Rider, this so-called heroic Knight Rider, no doubt going to burn black people's houses out or something, who knows. But he was a racialist, and he was the richest man at one stage in the South before the Civil War, because he was a slaver. He owned several slave plantations and all this sort of thing. And he's it's like raising up Adolf Hitler or something and calling him a hero or something and having a park his name. So there's been battles over this park for some time. Black people have had demonstrations. The Ku Klux Klan had counter demonstrations. Well, they provoked a demonstration in this year. And in March 30th of this year, we had a counter demonstration against the Klan. They said they were coming to protest the fact that the city council had changed the name or took down the name of this Klansman, Nathan Bedford Forrest. And so they said they're going to have a demonstration, and they're going to pour in, and according to them now, thousands of Klansmen and all this kind of thing. Well, it didn't happen that way, but it was, like 75, 80. but nevertheless, the fact that they had the demonstration forced us to step up, and have a counter demonstration. We fought the government. They didn't want to let us have anything. They were telling people to just ignore the Klan and they'll go away and all this kind of thing. Well, obviously that didn't happen, but we had the demonstration and we got 1,500 people to come out in protest. And that remains the largest anti-fascist demonstration this year anywhere, against the Ku Klux Klan or any other fascist entity. And it was spontaneous. Most of the protesters were from the black community. Memphis is a majority black city, 68% black, I think Jonina had said. And on the strength of this, obviously, you understand that there are people there who will fight the Ku Klux Klan. And the cops and nothing else deterred them from doing it. And they also were able to be educated about the complicity of the state and the cops. Memphis has a majority black city. It's got a black mayor and all this other garbage. And yet they continue to conspire to let the Ku Klux Klan do whatever the Klan wants to do. Recently, the Klan had another mobilization in the park there. And had, what, 200 members in full regalia and all this kind of thing, firing cannons and all. So we're fighting, and people are understanding that we're fighting the state. The Klan are just, you know, the paramilitary force that the government and these corporations use, you know, to try to destroy our movements. But, yeah, we are once again in conflict with the Klan. And I've been fighting the Klan personally, it seems, all my life, you know, one stage or another, fighting the Klan. And in Tennessee, they came out of Tennessee to begin with, so you would expect that they would still be strong there. There'd still be racist individuals as well as organizations.
Mm-hmm. But it's, as I understand it, it's not just the KKK that have kind of reinvigorated themselves. I mean, there's a vast constellation of other militias and white supremacist groups.
Right.
I mean,
this has been going on for years.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about the Ku Klux Klan is that it's based in Tennessee. Always has been, and although this particular group that came from what, Kentucky, and they were fighting with the group from Tennessee because the group from Tennessee felt like they were stepping on their toes and all. Oh, that's craziness.
Yeah, they're various clan factions. They don't have one central clan.
They have
different factions, and they operate independently. I mean, they're all racist and they're all terrorists.
Yeah.
But they don't always agree on strategy and tactics.
But at any rate, in fact, one of their strategies is with the new Confederate movement is to bring together fascist paramilitary forces, bring together racist debating societies and what have you, all kinds of racist groups. Now, the Tea Party, which is really the strongest right-wing group right now in the United States, has not come out publicly and joined them, although it's well known that they're in the ranks of the Tea Party. They have been for years. All these white supremacist organizations have been. But they, you know, they prefer to wear the suit and tie, you know, and they're, so they're genteel racists. But they are an extremely powerful organization at this stage. Probably the group that could, they run the state government in Tennessee, for instance, and they run it in several other states as well.
And they're responsible, the Tea Party faction of the Republican Party is responsible for the partial, at least they call it partial, shutdown of the U.S. government that just ended yesterday. They have, in the U.S. House of Representatives, part of our federal legislative body, they have control. And this was their attempt to, you know, they have control there. They're trying to get control of the entire Republican Party in the United States. So, but certainly in the state of Tennessee, they run that state. So people, poor people, low-income people, black people are living, who live in the state of Tennessee, you know, we're subjected to their policies.
Mm-hmm. And that's an incredibly worrying development that, you know, those tentacles of influence have reached up to that level. I mean, obviously, they were there before, but, I mean, you think that's kind of passed after the civil rights movement. I mean, is there, do you, are you active against the Tea Party, or do you not kind of bother with that level of...
Well, you know, we're organizing ultimately against all fascists, you know, because the Tea Party is an electoral party and we're not involved in electoral politics. We're not visible in fighting the Tea Party on that level. We have been visible. We have fought the Tea Party in terms of various state legislation and all this kind of thing. But we're not at this point based or organized in such a way that we can engage them. You know, they're not in Memphis on that level. That's a statewide movement, and they're strongest in Nashville. Now, we were in Nashville and so forth, but we were, you know, they were having meetings of thousands of white racists, you know, and everything. It wasn't even safe for us to be out there trying to counter demonstrate. So our thing was that we needed to be in Memphis, and they're not as strong in Memphis, and you know, and we're fighting them on a level we can fight them now. But it's the Klan that primarily is the threat around Memphis, because they are organizing. They're actually organizing white communities.
Well, I wanted to ask a question about organizing around class in the U.S. because it's something that's very understood in the U.K. and talked about politically, and perhaps race is sometimes not as much, but in the States, it's, there's this idea that everyone is middle class. Like, most people consider themselves to be middle class, or when they're asked, they think they're middle class. But, like, economically, that's definitely not the case. And there are very, you know, segmented, like, mm-hmm. portions of the U.S. And it's just, I guess my question is about how are you bringing the understandings of class and race together in your organizing? How do you, what is the practical aspects of your organizing look like, just so, you know, people here would understand what you're doing and what you're talking about and how you organize?
Well, the Black Autonomy Federation, you know, our focus is on poor, low-income, working-class Black people. You know, the point that you made earlier about the middle class, the politicians in the United States, from Obama on down, are always talking about how the middle class has been hurt, and we're going to enact this policy to help the middle class. Nobody talks about poor, low-income, working-class people. It's like they were invisible in the United States, but they do exist. So our focus is on poor, low-income, working-class Black people. The difficulty that we face right now in the United States is that the class contradictions among Black people in the United States are much sharper than they were back in the 60s and 70s, because back in those days you had maybe a middle-class Black people who would work right alongside lower-income, poor Black people in the Civil Rights Movement and also in the Black Power Movement. But now those contradictions are much more sharp, and you have some people in the Black community, those who have the middle class or who have, you know, made it or whatever, you know, oftentimes don't want anything to do with low-income, working-class Black people, consider them, you know, rabble or whatever, or criminals or whatever. So that's a real challenge for us now, because those class contradictions are really harder. But we do focus. Our message is clear. We're working to organize poor, low-income, working-class Black people. And, you know, other Black people who may be considered the middle class, you know, are not interested in that or don't see that as an issue, even though they themselves may have come out of poor income, you know, low-income Black communities. So that's what our focus is. You know, in terms of, you know, around the issues of race and class, we work with some white activists, white progressive activists. We work with some white anarchists, those who do work on issues of people of color. In the United States, the anarchist movement is a predominantly white movement, and does except for some very specific individual groups of anarchists, white anarchists. As a whole, the anarchist movement in the United States does virtually nothing in terms of issues around people of color, which, you know, I myself, I guess, would consider myself maybe a libertarian Marxist or whatever. I'm not an anarchist, and I'm not an anarchist because I've never seen them do anything that's really relevant to Black people, and consequently, I don't have time for that, you know. I'm not anti-white or anything like that, but because I am a Black woman, I'm focused on what's going on in my community. Mm. And you know, we try to have alliances with, you know, white activists. We formed a cult. When we did this anti-Klan demonstration in Memphis back in March, we formed a coalition, you know, a multiracial coalition, the Ida B. Wells Coalition Against Racism and Police Brutality. Ida B. Wells was a Black woman, a journalist, a feminist, born right after the Civil War in the United States. Her home was Memphis, Tennessee. She was invited to the UK in 1893 by white anti-racist organizations here because she had documented, as a journalist, had documented the hundreds of Black people that were being lynched and murdered by the Klan and other white racist groups after the U.S. Civil War. She had done her homework. She had all the information. So she was invited over here to the UK. In fact, I think she came twice to the UK. And that was quite something at that time for a Black woman to be doing that. But she was a brilliant woman, a powerful writer, an early Black feminist. And so, yes, she came over here to do that. So that's why we named our coalition after her, the Ida B. Wells Coalition Against Racism and Police Brutality. So we do work with people, you know, people who are not of African descent. Our group is, and we don't allow anyone other than black people to control our group. But we know we need to build those alliances, and we do that to the best of our ability.
You know, class politics has always been at the core of black autonomy in the first place. We created the Poor People Survival Movement way back when, you know, to deal with massive unemployment in the black community. And that's continuing to happen now. In fact, the black population of the black community is being hurt most by the so-called recession in the United States. We call it a depression. In fact, the statistics of the amount of black people who are out of work and who are impoverished are on the level of the so-called Great Depression of the 1930s, you know, over 25%, and in some age groups, even around 40% unemployed. And it is really having a negative impact on the community as a whole. When people don't have money and stuff, it leads, of course, to people, you know, victimizing each other and engaging in crime, whatever. And so we recognize this, and we have always recognized that we came into existence with this understanding that we were people from the bottom who were essentially on the bottom. You know, we had nothing to do with these middle class civil rights groups and all these other, you know, that wasn't our orientation from the first. And so we understand this, but we also understand the questions of race in a way it's structured in the United States and always has been, is that the capitalist system in the United States was created on the pedestal of racial slavery. Mm-hmm. Without racial slavery, there wouldn't have been a capitalist system. Although some doctrinaire white radical groups try to claim that it was European labor and European immigrants that you know created capitalism and so forth and so on, but it was chattel slavery. I mean, it's pretty clear. And because of this, has always been the situation where for most white people have felt in the United States, in order for them to advance or receiving or any kind of benefits or extra pay or whatever, they had to do it by stepping on black people, by keeping black people down. And this is one of the ways that has always assured oppression of not just black workers, certainly on the bottom, but the oppression of all workers, you know. But it's how the system is maintained today and how and the essential core of the system. So from our standpoint, we understand that to overthrow racism, we have to overthrow capitalism. We understand that, but we do not give in any way, shape, or form to some kind of sellout politic about black people should just stop doing what they're doing to fight for liberation, and to stop dealing with the levels of oppression they're receiving, just to follow behind some white radicals who don't even have a clue and probably from the middle class anyway, or maybe upper middle class, since we've seen organizations that are made up of well-to-do dropout college students and all this kind of thing. We don't follow behind those kind of people. We don't even work with those kind of people, to be quite honest, you know. We work with people who have a class consciousness and who have a consciousness and understanding that what's happening to black people is a result of class oppression. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is hard to make people understand. I've been arguing this for 40 years as an anarchist. When I first wrote Anarchism and the Black Revolution in 1979, you know, I was still in prison and have written other since and have had talks and whatever, is to make white people in the United States, white activists, understand that you are not going to somehow circumvent the whole question of, you know, slavery and racism and all these things coming into existence, and somehow it's not going to be recognized that this is also the maintenance of the system right now is racism and slavery. And so many black people are in prison to get free labor. I mean, you know, this is the new form. This is a new form of slavery. And it's no rhetorical flourish to say that, you know, when you got 2.3 million people in the system right now, and most of them are peoples of color, you know, so.
Yeah, and it's a huge employer as well, right?
It is a huge employer.
Mostly white people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that the centrality of the prison system, mm-hmm, in capitalism is...
In this period, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we are kind of coming to the end of our time limit, but mm-hmm. does anyone have a final question?
Well, I don't know. I guess if we kind of move away from the US and to the, mm-hmm. the place you are now, the UK, I mean, what's your view of how things are going here? I mean, the anarchist movement, the anti-racist movement, the anti-fascist movement. I mean, do you, you've obviously, you've been here before. You've kind of been around the country quite a lot on this tour. So, I mean, what's your assessment and what are we doing wrong? Why haven't we won yet?
Yeah. Well, I think, and everyone has talked about on this trip, you know, which is surprising to me because all the time I used to talk about it, nobody would really deal with it, is the fact that they still have not broken out of the activist ghetto, the activist white ghetto, that they still have not brought in and dealt with the conditions of people of color. And it's a problem in the sense that it's also a recognition that they still don't understand how, you know, they're expecting black people or some other people just walk in and sit down and say, well, I want to be an anarchist, not understanding that there is a historical relationship, there's a historical problem in relation to it, to dealing with peoples of color. They should be thinking of working, or especially with issues around racism and all these questions, they should be working with the peoples of color, following them, rather than expecting them to come in their drop-out spaces or whatever, you know what I'm saying, when there's no cultural affinity there at all. So I think that... That's one thing I still do notice, and everyone is beginning to talk about it. I think that, for instance, the prison issue, just as in the States, the activists in the Anarchist Black Cross and other white-led movements still don't understand that in the prisons, they're going to have to deal with this racialized imprisonment where large numbers of prisoners of color are in there in disproportionate numbers, and the movement still doesn't understand what that really means and why they have to organize around that. They're going to have to deal, you know, and I still think they haven't dealt enough with these high security control, what we call them, control units, because that's what they were back in the day. They were control units, these facilities. The nature of prison has changed now, you know, to where you could go to prison for anything and be in solitary confinement the whole time you're there. You know what I'm saying? And behavior modification and all these things that when I was in prison were just coming into the fore and was used to break the black prison, the black-led prison movement and the radical prison movement. That was used to break it. I still don't think many people understand that this what they learned, what the state learned from this is being used right now. They still haven't figured that out here or in the States, to be quite honest. So I still think it's the question of building not just race unity or some fake black-white united fight, but to deal with how the institutions are using racism, how the government is using racism. They've gone to another stage with mass imprisonment of black people, and that's something that's really not even recognized right now among most activists.
And I just wanted to also, before we, you know, close out, to invite people. We would, you know, the Ida B. Wells Coalition, it was started in the United States. So we would like, because Ida B. Wells did come here to the UK, we would like to work with anti-racist activists here in the UK, mm-hmm. Because you have your own struggle here against racism and police brutality, which obviously you have to fight. We can't fight it from the United States just as you can't fight our struggle, but we want to have international solidarity movement around those issues. So I just wanted to give our email address if people are interested in becoming part of that, so that we know people here may want to form a UK branch. That's obviously up to them, but the email address is organize, O-R-G-A-N-I-Z-E, we spell it with a Z in the States, Z-E dot THE.hood, HOOD, at gmail.com. And you also will find some information about it. We're trying to get it on our website, but if you go to our Facebook page, Black Autonomy Federation, we're on Facebook, you'll get more information about the kinds of things we're doing.
Fantastic.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, like I said before, there's a plethora of other things we really would have liked to talk about and go into to more detail. I guess if people who are listening right now want to find out more and talk to you in person, the Anarchist Book Fair is the place to be. When are you speaking?
It says here on the program that I have in front of me here on 2 to 3, you're having the discussion around the radical wing of the Black Power movement in the United States, 1965 to 1973. And then from 5 to 6, the discussion about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, new Confederacy movements, and the anti-racist movement for this period. Mm-hmm. So and if people want to know more, plug, check out their earlier mentioned books. I've driven by the movement. Yeah, that I really want to read.
Activists of the Black Power Era. It's my book and Lorenzo's book. Lorenzo actually has two. There's Anarchism and the Black Revolution, and then he also has The Progressive Plantation: Racism Inside White Radical Social Change Groups, which might be of particular interest to some. White anarchists working here in the UK on these issues of racism.
Excellent. Thank you very much for chatting to us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us come. Thank you.
Pleasure's been all ours.